This week, we speak to the creator of a new movie which has been released about Apollo 15, which is called Galileo's Moon.
Yes, we're joined by David Woods, who has also edited a number of incredible videos for the Apollo Flight Journal.
Have you seen the movie? Let us know what you thought. You can do this via our social media pages at Space and Things Podcast on Threads, Instagram, and Facebook, or via the contact form on our website.
And please consider joining us over at patreon.com/spaceandthings. Right now, it's time for episode 184 of the Space and Things podcast.
You're listening to the Space and Things podcast with Dave Giles and Emily Carney.
I'm Emily Carney.
And I'm Dave Giles. Welcome to episode 184 of our podcast. How are you doing, Emily?
I am hanging in there. How you doing, Dave?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. Had a fairly good week, fairly busy. Announced some new tour dates, which is always fun. Haven't done that
awesome.
For a while.
Awesome. I saw that. That's exciting. Really good.
Dipping my feet into that world again, which I haven't done since pre-COVID. So it's very much was my old life, was doing little tours over the UK and Europe a few times a year, but I haven't done it since COVID. For various reasons. So yeah, trying to get it going again. So I'll put some details in the show notes if those of you in the UK are near Manchester, Nottingham or London and fancy seeing me sing some songs, then you can check that out. Anyway, before we get started on to our main feature this week, we had some sad news last week. The astronaut Richard Truly passed away aged 86.
Admiral Richard Truly's career spanned from the aircraft cockpit to the heights of NASA management. Born on November 12, 1937, in Fayette, Mississippi, his naval career began with his graduation from Georgia Tech's Naval ROTC program, a program that also produced the career of another future early space shuttle program commander, John Young. After becoming a naval aviator from 1963 to 1965, Truly was a student, then an instructor, at the challenging U.S. Air Force Aerospace Research Pilot School at Edwards Air Force Base, California. Edwards would later be the site of his future shuttle program triumphs. In 1965, Truly was selected for the Manned Orbiting Laboratory Program, or MOL, M-O-L, which would have served as one of the U.S. first space stations. However, the purpose of MOL, to perform surveillance utilizing a high-resolution orbiting camera, was kept classified for decades. In Truly's words from a 2003 NASA oral history.
So suddenly, I was in an astronaut program, and we worked like the devil from that day until the program was eventually cancelled in 1969 by President Nixon. It was a classified program, but we eventually moved down to Los Angeles. The MOL program office was located in El Segundo, so I was a MOL astronaut from the press conference until the day the program was cancelled, which all of us in the program still refer to as Black Tuesday. It was a Tuesday, the 10th of June, 1969.
The MOL astronauts were devastated by Black Tuesday, but many of its members were, however, reluctantly, as NASA had very little work for them, absorbed in the U.S. Space Agency's astronaut corps that same year. This 1969 astronaut group boasted many future space shuttle legends, including Robert Crippen, Gordon Fullerton, Hank Hartsfield, and others, and included Truly. During the long decade of the 70s, Truly was busy with projects encompassing the Skylab and Apollo-Soyuz test project missions, but by 1976, he had finally gained a plumb flying assignment. Enterprise, despite not being an orbiting space shuttle, was critical to the space shuttle's program success, as it would verify the airworthiness of the shuttle and how it landed on a lake bed and an airstrip. Truly was partnered as a pilot along with X-15 legend and commander Joe H. Engel, and in 1977, made two of the five approach and landing tests, or ALT, free flights. In 1978, Engel as commander and Truly as a pilot were again announced as one of the space shuttle's first orbital flight crews. After innumerable delays, STS-2 finally got off the launch pad into the history books on November 12, 1981, which was Truly's 44th birthday. Despite the early failure of a fuel cell, this two-day mission was a success and it accomplished most of its objectives. In August 1983, Trulli was at the helm of Challenger during STS-8, which was the shuttle program's first night launch. What Trulli didn't know then was how Challenger would guide the rest of his spaceflight career at NASA. After a time as the commander of the Naval Space Command, Trulli returned to NASA as its associate administrator in the wake of the Challenger accident. Trulli guided the shuttle program for nearly 3 years in this role as it prepared for its return to flight, made by STS-26 Discovery in September 1988. From 1989 to 1992, Trulli served as NASA's administrator, guiding the middle years of the shuttle program as it recovered from Challenger and headed towards newer projects such as Shuttle Mir. Following his NASA retirement, Trulli returned to where it all began, Georgia Tech, as its vice president and director of the Georgia Tech Research Institute. He was even memorialized as a character on the Apple TV Plus show For All Mankind, as leading NASA during the 1990s, an appropriate tribute to one of the astronaut-turned-leaders of the time. An essential part of the space shuttle story, Trulli will be missed. His legacy is momentous. We extend our deepest condolences to Trulli's family, colleagues, and friends.
Yeah, very sad news indeed. What I found interesting, actually, what I hadn't noticed before until you read it out loud, he died at age 86, and his first shuttle mission, he was 44. So
yeah,
he was over halfway through his life before he first got to space. A long life as well. 86, you know, it's good. I don't know, it just filled me with a little bit of hope about the future for myself. Do you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Like,
there's still so much to achieve with our life. Most of what you just read happened in the second half of his life, which I think is really fascinating, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. He did a lot, and he did a lot in his 40s and 50s. So that's really, yeah, for me as a 46-year-old, I'm like, I still got it. Yeah.
Yeah, still time. All right.
It's still time.
Anyway, let's move on to this week's main feature. A new film called Galileo's Moon has just been released about the Apollo 15 mission. It's available to watch for free online, and I'll put a link in the show notes for you to go and watch it. And today we speak to its creator, David Woods.
David curates and edits the Apollo Flight Journal, a website at NASA, which, along with the renowned Apollo Lunar Surface Journal, is seen as a canonical resource for anyone wishing to study the missions in great detail. He was presented with a Special Service Award by NASA for making their history books available online, and he has since written a number of books on the topic, including the highly regarded How Apollo Flew to the Moon. This weaves technical descriptions of the Apollo flights into a narrative that follows a composite mission from launch to splashdown. He also wrote three Haynes manuals, one on the Lunar Rover, one on the Gemini spacecraft, and another on the Saturn Saturn V. So let's talk to David Woods.
You're listening to Space and Things, which attempts to answer the question, what happens when a musician and a writer get together to make a podcast?
Welcome, David. Thank you very much for joining us today. So first things first, we ask this question a lot on Space and Things. So what got you into space flight, Apollo in particular?
To be truthful, it's a long story. It would start at being, age 9, 10. The BBC in the UK gave a lot of coverage to the Apollo program and sort of very impressionable young, not quite a teenager kid. It was enchanting and just a marvelous thing. That all falls away as you get into further education and career, such like, and then it picks up again. The big change was the discovery on the internet in about 1994. I was one of the first people around here to get the internet, and I came across the Apollo Lunar Surface Journal, which I still think is one of the greatest websites out there. I became slightly involved in that. And as part of that, I suggested to the editor of that journal, why don't we do something that covers the flights? Because he had just covered the surface parts of Apollo. And when that happened, he put me in touch with one of the astronauts that had been on the moon, which astonished me. And that was David Scott of Apollo 15. And David was more than happy to answer questions by email as I went through the transcripts of the flight to the moon, the flights around the moon, and the flight back from the moon, explaining things. And he would fill out some details that at that time I wouldn't know. And so that kind of tells you how I got into Apollo, and then how I was lucky enough to get some sort of a link with Dave Scott.
Amazing.
So you're the author of several spaceflight books, including How Apollo Flew to the Moon, which is an indispensable book for those wanting to know how the Apollo program was carried out. So how do you keep Apollo, which is really a 60-year-old program, fresh and exciting for readers?
Apollo may be 60 years old, but the adventure is still fresh because nobody has been back since then. And even if the technology is relatively aged, the basic techniques behind it for spaceflight are almost as current now as they were then. So one of the things that my main book, How Apollo Flew to the Moon, one of the main things that does is it gives you a kind of spaceflight 101 lesson. You know, it talks about some of the basics of celestial navigation, celestial mechanics, how orbits work, and all that sort of stuff before taking you into the actual details of all the flights. And they're fascinating and, you know, interesting. And I'd add on to that, that the folk who were carrying that out were really pushing the boundaries of what humans could do at that time with the technology they had. And I guess just like following tales of polar explorers and, you know, people going up Everest and whatever, no matter what age it was done in, it's still fascinating to see human endeavor at that scale. It's just wonderful stuff.
Absolutely. Interesting to say that the story is still fresh because no one's been back. I wonder, have you been to the Moonwalkers exhibit? Or is it an exhibit? I don't know what it is. In King's Cross in London, the Tom Hanks thing.
I have been. I was actually very slightly involved in it.
Oh, were you?
Because they were looking for audio samples, and I've got just about all the Apollo audio samples available here. I once wrote a book, Haynes Owner's Workshop Manual, about the lunar rover, and my co-writer was Chris Riley.
Oh, yes.
The film director, you know, documentary director and producer. He co-produced In the Shadow of the Moon, and he also did Moon Machines. And it was him who was co-writing the script, I believe, with Tom Hanks. And he came to me for help with finding these audio samples. So last month, my wife and I went down south to London and we got a showing there. And I could feed my thoughts back to Chris about, you know, what I saw. And so it's like, it was great. I was very impressed. I would call it a presentation. You know, what was it, 50, 55 minute presentation?
Yeah, absolutely. It just strikes me as being very fresh. And that was what, as soon as you said the word fresh, I was like, oh yeah, it is fresh. And I think modern technology enables us to experience it again, even more fresh.
You're also a video editor and responsible for the many treasures on the Apollo Flight Journal channel on YouTube, which you discussed. Yes. The Apollo Flight Journal a little bit earlier. So again, how do you discern what content to use, given that there is a lot of Apollo footage available online, but, you know, not all of it is, I guess, like, special. Some of it we've seen a lot of. So how do you discern what to put on your channel?
Well, so my background is I've had a full career as a video editor with the BBC in Scotland. And because of that, you get experience in what works for viewers. You just know instinctively that this is good stuff to put up and don't put that up, such like. So you want to tell stories. And my professional life, although I came from an engineering background, the changing technology forced me down the line of creative endeavor. And so you become aware of what you think might work as a presentation to give to people. And that's kind of where the things I've made for YouTube and for the Apollo Flight Journal come from. I've been astonished at the high quality of the photography and the 16mm movie documentation of Apollo. Some of it is just wonderful stuff. And it's only in this generation that we're really getting to see it. It was never available in high resolution. It is now. You can go online and everything is there just about. So once you have that, you can start to do things with it. And a very good example is the Apollo Remastered book by Andy Saunders, where he takes that material and presents it. And that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm telling stories with it. And one of the most interesting stories is, for example, the descent of Apollo 11. It was charged with difficulties and, you know, possibilities of things going wrong. And it tells the story of pilots and engineers working together in order to overcome these obstacles and achieve something that is just at the top level of human endeavor. So I've got a particular approach. Because I know how to edit on a particular platform, I could take that technology and I could pull that together with all the various strands that I want to display. Because of my researches for my books and for the journal, I had the PDF document, which gives you every 2 seconds the altitude of the lunar module from the surface and what the pitch angle was of the lunar module. And that covers the entire descent. So I could use those numbers to drive aspects of that video and just, you know, enhance the presentation even more. And for the Apollo 11 one, I've been absolutely astounded at how well that's gone down on YouTube. It's had 2.5 million views, which is lovely.
Yeah, I think about a million of those are my views. So. I've watched a lot. So now on to Apollo 15 in the new movie. So despite its status as Apollo's first dedicated science mission and the first mission with a lunar roving vehicle, Apollo 15 seems somewhat obscure and appealing to Apollo completists only in a way. So how do you manage to address that putting together this new film, Galileo's Moon?
So there's a little story. You know, I knew Dave Scott, the commander of Apollo 15, quite well. He had helped me with my journal. He wrote the foreword for how Apollo flew to the moon. And he had come to visit Glasgow once. I invited him to Glasgow when he was living in London, and we reviewed his mission from the point of view of the flight portion. So I knew him and I'd met him on a few occasions. And when it came to the 50th anniversary of Apollo 15, he knew me for my Apollo work. What he didn't know at that time was what I did for a living. And he was thinking of arranging a celebration of Apollo 15's 50th anniversary, and he wanted to show a short film, but he needed an editor. And he was chatting with Ken McTaggart, another Apollo Scotsman, and he says, I need an editor. Well, Dave Woods is your man, because he knows your mission very, very well, and that's what he does for a living. Does he? It'll be perfect. So I found myself being brought on board in 2021 to help Dave make a video to show at this anniversary celebration that was held in San Diego. That went down very well. I think Dave saw the possibility for something where, you know, we take more time and it's better made, and we can tell a wider story of the mission, how it came together. And we acquired a lot of the training film, you know, the 16mm film that had been shot, the various training things. Through film researcher Stephen Slater, I had access to a lot of that stuff and to all the flight footage as well. And I know the photographic record very well because I've done the Apollo 15 flight journal. And so we just worked by email for 2.5 years, refining this and taking it the way they wanted it, and I'm throwing in my ideas. It was a wonderful email collaboration. It's just a joy when you can get to throw in your own skills and ideas, and you're helping somebody see their vision, and your ideas are helping them even further. Nice example of that I'm very proud of is, so for those who don't know, the Apollo 15 Command Service Module had repurposed spy cameras built into the side of the spacecraft. These were taking thousands of very high resolution photographs of the surface. And all of these, 3,000 of them from Apollo 15, are available online, scanned very, very high resolution. And I knew them because I'd produced them all and used them in my journal, but I don't think Dave knew them that well. He knew they were there, but he didn't know the details of it. So I took a whole pile of these that I knew and downloaded them and stitched them together into long panoramas. And then you can fly a virtual camera over them. With the help of my nephew, who's a videographics guy, we got hold of a texture map of the moon, and we draped these old Apollo 15 photographs over it and then flew over them the way it would look from orbit. So that's a unique sequence in the film set to Rodrigo's music. It's a unique sequence that I don't think any other editor might have come up with. And it's just because I know the material very intimately.
That is fascinating. Wow. Okay. So there is also a lot of great candid, like, personal footage from the movie, such as the footage of, you know, Scott and Irwin geology training and the crew making zero-G parabolic flights, et cetera, et cetera. What is your favorite candid footage, and was there anything on the cutting room floor that we might see in the future?
We only got to use tiny snippets of the amount of footage that we got hold of. I very much like the zero-G stuff. Well, it's not quite zero-G, it's actually 6G, because in the film you can see Dave Scott, he's practicing getting on and off the rover. So they were doing 6G flights. That's fascinating stuff. It's great to see. I enjoy all, you know, seeing all the geology stuff and seeing the extent to which they prepared. I think one of the most interesting aspects of Apollo 15 is that it was so devoted to science, and they really took it on board. And I think it's something to very much Scott's credit, is that he embraced science for that mission so much. And one of my favorite parts of that is to see him doing the hammer and the feather experiment towards the end of the time on the moon. It says something about his devotion to the science behind it. And to me, that's a better thing than hitting golf balls. And there might be a subtext in that. I'm not sure. Is there stuff on the cutting room floor? There's acres of stuff on the cutting room floor, unfortunately. I enjoy all the mission control stuff as well. I mean, it doesn't show that much, but just having the atmosphere and seeing the place is really interesting.
Yeah, what was the Dave Scott quote after he dropped the feather? Nothing like a bit of science on the moon is what I always say, which always makes me laugh. I'm interested in where all this footage comes from. So you said that a lot of it's available online. The training footage and the flight footage, is that all in the NASA archives as well? Or is that separate stuff from the mission videos that we see a little bit more of?
So the flight footage, that was all acquired by Stephen Slater for various documentary projects that he worked on. And quite a while ago, he supplied me with copies of that to use on the journal. So what I've done over the years, I haven't done it for all the missions yet, and I need to really finish this project, but the Apollo Flight Journal has a whole bunch of YouTube channels, one for each mission. And if you go to the likes of Apollo 11 House and Apollo Flight Journal on YouTube, all the flight footage, you know, the 16 millimeter footage that was shot for Apollo 11 is there. And I've done that for most of the missions. So I already had the Apollo 15 flight footage courtesy of Stephen Slater. What happened for this film specifically is that Stephen applied to, I think it's the National Archives in the United States. I think they have all the original 16 millimeter reels. Can't remember how many, but there's more than a dozen, maybe 20. They were all scanned to high definition, and those files were sent to me, and then I could look through them, pick out what I want, and put them in the film. So they're all sitting in the National Archives, I believe, all the training stuff, things like training stuff and the stuff that was shot in the morning of launch. It's all in the National Archives, but it costs a fortune to get it out, you know, to get it scanned.
So does that mean that you were watching stuff that perhaps hasn't been seen since those film cans were put away 50 years ago?
Possibly, although, I mean, there are low-quality versions available for, you know, they're called proxies, available for people who want to do film research for a documentary. You know, so that's what we did in the first place. We looked at proxies and said, well, that's a good deal, we'll have that. So it's possible that other people involved in documentaries in the past have seen this, but...
Right.
As you say, it's very possible that nobody has looked at this stuff in 50 years.
Wow.
So what do you hope viewers, whether they're new to Apollo or diehard enthusiasts, can gain from watching Galileo's move?
A reasonably accurate impression of what it was like. The vast scope of the exploration that Dave Scott and Jim Irwin were doing. You know, the idea that they travel miles across the lunar surface and they're working next to mountains that are like 4.5 kilometers high, next to Hadley Rail. It's just spectacular. See, what was it? There's that episode of From the Earth to the Moon, the Tom Hanks 1998 drama series, and they have one specific episode for Apollo 15, which manages to take geology and make it into an interesting drama subject, which is fabulous. But in that, there's a line by the actor who's playing Dave Scott. He says, there's something about the exploration of beautiful places is good for the soul. Something of that ilk. And I think that's what I hope the film does. I watched a lecture recently given by Dave Scott's daughter, Tracy. She's a professor. And she gave this lecture, which is what it's like to be the daughter of, you know, somebody who's been to the moon. And in that, she talks about the film, and she talks about, she describes this film as being Dave Scott's answer to the question, what was it like to go to the moon? Well, here it is. This is what it was like.
Yeah.
And if it achieves that, I will be extremely happy, because that's what Dave and I are trying to achieve. Most, not all, but most of the music is contemporaneous to that period of time. So it's to give a sense of what he was listening to while he was going about, going from place to place, you know.
Fantastic. And are there any other projects you've got coming up that we might be able to know about at this stage, or is everything a bit hush-hush?
Mostly what I do is I work away in the background on the Apollo Flight Journal. I'm always enhancing it. I just recently published the sequel to the Apollo 11 landing video, which is the Apollo 12 landing video, called Apollo 12, The Complete Descent. And that's picking up a lot of interest on YouTube. That's great fun. And I'm now starting to think about doing one for Apollo 14, and I'll work my way through. I made these videos for all the missions quite a few years ago, but they were done to a relatively simple degree. And one of the things I've learned doing stuff for YouTube is that you can approach this kind of editing in a different manner to the way you would approach television editing. Because for television, you get, most people get to see it once and it's gone. And so you don't give them too much information at once because they just can't take it all in. You know, so you tend to keep things quite simple. So the earlier versions I made of these landing videos, I kept them relatively simple. I didn't want to put too much in. And then I realized that for YouTube, people can just go back and watch it again and again and again. And so just make it rich. And I threw everything at the Apollo 11 one. I've got the mission control audio happening at the same time as the air to ground audio. And I've got little meters showing the height off the ground, and, you know, just an explanation's coming up all the time to explain what's going on at each moment. So I make it rich. And that's what I'm trying to do with this new series, is I'm just going to work through all the landings and make really rich, full-on versions of all those incredible descents and landings on the moon.
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, David. We really appreciate your time, and hopefully
no
a few more of our listeners will now head over and watch the movie, and also go and dig out what you've been doing for the Flight Journal as
well. Go watch the movie.
So yeah, hopefully we'll speak to you again soon, David. Thanks very much for joining us.
No problem. Be my pleasure.
That's one small step for... Oh my... What is that thing?
Well, thank you, Gavin Jennings, for that wonderful sting. But anyway, Emily, you've seen the movie. What did you think?
Oh, gosh. I'm a little biased. I love Apollo 15 anyway, because it was just such a... Compared to the missions before it, it was just so much more complex. I mean, it was the first dedicated science mission. It had a lunar roving vehicle. It had all the cool experiments on the command module and the SIM satellite, or the satellite in the SIM bay, I should say, the little satellite that Worden deployed. And there were just so many firsts associated with Apollo 15. I just absolutely loved it. What I really thought was amazing was I loved how you felt like when they were flying the descent, when Irwin and Scott were flying the descent to the lunar surface, you felt like you were with them or something. Like you felt like you were in the lunar module with them, because it basically showed everything they did during that time. It showed the computer programs that were being fed to the computer. It showed basically what the lunar module was doing, what altitude above the surface it was, or, you know, the moment of touchdown. And it had also, you know, obviously their verbal cues as well. And, you know, you could hear Irwin calling, you know, the altitude and the degrees off. You felt like you were really with them, which was amazing. Irwin and Warden are no longer with us, unfortunately. Irwin is kind of a lesser known quantity in spaceflight only because he died very young. He's been gone for, God, over 30 years. And it was just cool to hear Irwin's voice kind of tell the story from all those years ago. It was like a gift from time almost. I loved it.
Yeah, nice.
I loved the footage of them on the lunar surface, the photos that were stitched together. I mean, you just felt like you were there. I've always felt sort of a sadness because I, like many space enthusiasts, I missed out on Apollo. I wasn't born until years later. You know, I was always like, man, I wish I'd been alive during these missions, you know, and
yeah,
so I could understand them and so I could see them. And this is about as close I feel, honestly, with movies like this, with Galileo's Moon. I honestly felt like I wasn't there, but I can say with some confidence, okay, I know what it was like. You know, I mean,
yeah.
So I just love it. I think it's amazing. It's also free, which is really, I think, mm-hmm. generous. I would have paid to see it. I would have paid probably decent money to see it.
Yeah, I felt the same. I felt the same.
You got to see it. It's really good.
Yeah, of course, I will put a link in the show notes so that people can go and watch that. But I think it's also worth pointing out that David's other work that he's done with the Flight Journal and the videos he's put up on the Flight Journal YouTube, they're amazing as well, aren't they? I mean, we have both, well, I think we've messaged before about how good they are.
Like, yes.
We've gone through lots of stuff about those before. They're such a great resource. And it's great that he's been putting those together. So it feels right that we've interviewed him as well, finally.
Finally, yeah. He's done so much. I've admired David for, God, I know I met him at Tucson Space Fest, I think 8 years ago. And I've just admired his work for ages. I mean, ever since I heard about him, I love his work. I think what he does with the Apollo Flight Journal is incredible. And it's not only a great resource for people who love Apollo and who research Apollo, but it's just a lot of fun as well. It's just fun to watch those, you know. You can fire them up and just watch them, and it's like you're just spellbound. So, yep, can't say enough about them.
Yeah, and I think I want to just hark back to what he said. Oh, I think it was in the second question where he said the images and the videos, the story of Apollo is still very fresh, even though it is 56 years ago, because we haven't been back since. And I think the other aspect of that is that us being able to view things in higher definition than ever before and really get into that, into what they brought back, as in the photos and the videos, we can now do that to a level we've never been able to before. And there's more and more stuff coming out. You know, it goes back to the Apollo 11 movie that we've talked about in depth. You know, seeing that high definition videos on big screens or even in bigger screens at home,
yeah.
The experience we get as viewers of Apollo is so different to what it would have been at the time.
Yeah.
That if in many ways, it may well be fresher now than it was when it was happening.
Exactly.
Which is kind of crazy. But we do get those experiences now, that, you know, these incredible high definition experiences.
Yeah.
Like what I talked about with the Lightroom production that's happening in London at the moment. It's just amazing. And yeah, in the past, you would only necessarily get them if there was an odd IMAX thing came out, but there wasn't any Apollo IMAXs, or if you happen to go to one of the space museums, they may have something in a big screen. But now we can do it at home on YouTube, on our big screen, on our computers, or even on our phone. The quality of the definition on our phones is so good. We get to experience anything and feel like we're really in it. And I think that's, we're very lucky. We are very lucky to be alive right now.
Oh yeah,
and for Apollo still to be landing, pardon the pun, with such an impact that it does, because I think it means that people are still creating stuff off the back of it with this content. Anyway, as I said, I'll put links to loads of stuff in the show notes. You'll find out more about David and the videos he has made, and of course this new movie, Galileo's Moon.
every single place in the observable universe is either space or a thing. So this podcast is really about everything.
So, Emily, what's caught your eye in spaceflight this week?
One thing that's caught my eye this week, in spacenews.com, there's an article by Jeff Faust, and it's called NASA Studies to Examine Commercial Partnerships for Mars Exploration. This caught my eye because we've obviously, on this show, talked to a space policy expert, Casey Dreyer, about a lot about Mars exploration and the Mars sample return missions in particular, which are currently in danger. Now, these plans would be different from the Mars sample return. The article makes it clear that it's for after those Mars sample returns, but this is basically a strategy for future Mars exploration, because right now there are several spacecraft on or around Mars, but many of them are very old. I think there's a Mars, I want to say like a Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter or something like that. I don't know if it's called that. It's quite a few years old. It's definitely not a new spacecraft. So basically, and this is verbatim from the mission, Erica Janson, I-A-N-S-O-N, who is the director of Mars Exploration Program. What's interesting about this program is it's coming from a commercial standpoint. So, quote, Eric said, "We are really interested to see what the commercial sector can provide from a commercial standpoint." And they're evaluating studies that would be published sometime in the summer. And it's basically to see how these partnerships could address the current gaps in Mars infrastructure. And as I stated earlier, a lot of the Mars spacecraft are getting older. Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has been up, I want to say, for about 2 decades, which is quite some time for a spacecraft. As we know, spacecraft don't last forever. The article is very careful to make it clear this isn't the same thing as this isn't like a Mars commercial lunar payload services. This is a little different. There are some differences. Quoting Lori Glaze, the director of NASA's Planetary Science Division, it's a different business model, but the idea of a service approach is something worth exploring. So this really caught my eye. I'm really interested. The idea of exploring Mars using commercial spacecraft and not necessarily NASA or JPL spacecraft, to me, is very intriguing. We're seeing NASA use that approach right now for moon exploration. I don't want to sound grim, but so far they've had very mixed success with that, though. This is a study. I want to make it clear they haven't decided on anything yet, but I just thought this was a neat way to go about it. You know, NASA kind of having private and public different partnerships. I think that's really cool. And now they're trying to extend it to Mars. So very interesting. And of course, we will have the link to this article in the show notes as well. So it's from spacenews.com, written by Jeff Faust.
Interesting, this one, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is interesting. I feel like it's a shift change from NASA.
Yeah.
To even have this study. And I feel like it's almost a little bit disappointing. I feel like commercial companies are going to go to Mars anyway at some point.
They are, yeah.
I always assumed when commercial programs started, when the idea was that would help NASA sort out all the low Earth orbit stuff, leaving them the chance to do their own exploration of further afield. And with all these budget cuts that seem to be happening and the other missions that seem to be getting cut in, it seems like this is the only way to make further afield happen as well. Not that I think that's a bad thing. I think commercial programs have got a lot to add to NASA, and I think that can really help. But I just think it's little bit sad that NASA has to feel like it has to do something to cover this gap in their funding, which keeps on getting, well, it doesn't keep on getting cut in, but certainly seems to struggle to keep up with the costs of things.
There's a few parallels, I think, between right now and the 1970s in a way, because in the late 70s, early 80s, the space shuttle program was, I mean, frankly, using up so much budget. Obviously, a lot of resources had to be cut from a lot of other areas, and there were a bunch of planetary science missions in the early 80s that got cut as well. The original Magellan got cut. It was Venus, like a radar mapper, but it was way more ambitious than what actually got launched. So that got canceled. So granted, they didn't have really commercial and NASA partnerships back then. So that's a big difference. The business model was very much different back then, but still, I find it similar because I find that they're sort of finding, you know, okay, we got to shrink the budget, but we got to find alternatives now. At least yeah. That's an option that they can try to find a commercial alternative that may be more budget conscious, I guess. Something that's, you know, a little more budget friendly, because I love NASA and JPL, but they're not known for making, you know, very budget friendly spacecraft. You know, you look at something like Perseverance and it's a big rover, you know, not exactly, you know, inexpensive and stuff. And, you know, there's probably a lot that could be said for maybe smaller spacecraft. Who knows? Or, you know, less complex spacecraft. So
I think it's more what Casey was talking about when we spoke to him a few weeks back, that when you do things inside a government, it is more expensive.
Yeah.
When you do something within a government, some of the efficiencies you get from private enterprise, having a dictator at the top, for example, being able to make quick decisions and
yeah.
not having to run everything past committees and so on and so forth, makes things cheaper. And it's just as much about that
exactly
than it is what the spacecraft can do themselves. But it doesn't mean I feel like we're going to have less or worse off space program. I think it probably means the opposite. I think it's having a bit of everything involved, NASA and private enterprise, is the way forward, in my opinion. But yeah, I liked the idea, similar to what we spoke about with Casey. I liked that idea of it being in-house with NASA and then being given the funding to do what we want yeah. them to do. Anyway, it's an interesting article. So yes, we'll put that within the show notes.
Yeah. So has anything caught your eye this week, Dave?
Well, the two big stories are, for me, were the fact that Crew 8 launched on a SpaceX Dragon. So we have four new members up on the ISS. And again, if you want to learn more about those people, check the link I've put in the show notes. And while we're talking about astronauts, NASA has graduated the next class of astronauts, the 23rd group of astronauts, and they're called the Flyers, and apparently they're ready to fly. So they've got through. We announced that these people had been selected to be ASCANS astronaut candidates a couple of years ago, and they've gone through their training and passed, and they're ready to be selected for some missions now. So that's pretty cool. And on the same day, NASA has announced that the books are open again. You can now apply to be an astronaut once again.
Yes.
Are you going to do it, Emily? Are you going to apply?
Oh, God, I would. I actually tried to apply years ago, but I'll just be honest. The application was so intimidating that I kind of gave up, because there's the section where they're basically like, how many PhDs do you have? And I'm like, really? No, I'm not going to make it. 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 There's no way. I'm not saying that people shouldn't apply for this, but this, and I want to state that this was like 14 or 15 odd years ago. So things have probably changed a lot in the application process now. But yeah, I was so intimidated by the application, I kind of gave up. And plus, I hate saying this, if you actually go and look at these people's resumes, I'm just like, never mind. I mean, they're some of these people like, yeah, I was a master driller in Alaska. And I'm like, really? Wow. I do not have anything in my professional portfolio that can match up to that. And that's something that obviously would be, you would need probably if you're drilling on the moon. Just stuff like that. So I don't know if I'll apply this time. I definitely don't think I would make it. And plus, I don't know if they would want a 46-year-old woman with a bunch of health stuff. So we'll see. Maybe they do. I mean, if they do.
Maybe they do. Exactly.
Maybe they do.
I just had a look. To apply to be an astronaut for NASA, you need a master's degree in a STEM field. So science, technology, engineering, or maths. There are certain degrees that don't count, such as nursing, psychology, exercise, physiology, or social sciences. So you don't need a PhD anymore.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I don't think you ever needed a PhD, but you certainly needed I think you've always needed a degree of some kind, but you need a master's degree.
Yeah, and I know people who have applied and have gotten turned down in the past. I mean, you look at their resume and they're like, why didn't they make it? You know, but who knows? I mean, yeah. I'm sure there's a lot that goes into that decision-making process. And obviously I'm not privy to the, to the thinking behind that, but I'm not trying to tell people don't apply. I think if you're qualified, you definitely should go for it. Why not? And if you don't make it, at least you can frame that rejection letter.
Oh yeah.
good or point. You could try again next time. I mean, there's nothing that says you can't.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've spoken to Clay Anderson, who applied many times, and it's well documented that not many seem to get in on their first go. So, yes.
Exactly. Jim Lovell didn't.
No.
So.
There you go.
You're listening to Space and Stuff. What was that? Space and Things. You're listening to Space and Things.
Okay. That's it for this week. Thank you for joining us once again. Good news, Emily. I've got some good news. We're getting closer to our Patreon goal. We're just 6 people away. We need just 6 people to sign up to reach 100 Patreon subscribers before episode 200. And that was a goal we set when we had show 150 to determine whether we would carry on making the podcast or not. It's not that we don't want to make it, but it's simply a matter of trying to make it work financially. We started doing all this during COVID lockdowns, and obviously the real world has opened up over the last couple of years, and it's a lot harder to make time to do it each week. We haven't missed a week, but it has been hard, and I actually turned down paid work opportunities to keep this going. I hope that shows how committed I've been to making it. But while having 100 Patreon subscribers does not mean we're going to be making huge amounts of money from the podcast for how much time we put into it, it does justify it enough for me to continue doing so. Of course, I don't want to stop at 100 either. If we can grow it even further, we'll have a budget, hopefully, to do more cool things like we did in January. But for now, we're just trying to balance the book somehow. So if you're willing and able, please consider joining us and head over to patreon.com/spaceandthings. There are plenty of little perks that you get from joining as well. And we're always trying to improve it as time goes on, and we'll happily take advice on how we can improve it if people have ideas. But if you don't care for any of the perks, it's just great to help us out if you want to as well. So head over to patreon.com/spaceandthings.
Yes, and thank you to all who have signed up. And a huge shout out to both Larry Puzio and Logan Yaron, who have been offering some extra perks to people to sign up. Search for their post at Space Hipsters if you want an extra incentive to join. So anyway, thank you for listening to the podcast. Please consider sharing it with your spaceflight loving friends too. And don't forget, in space, no one can hear you meep.
This has been the Space and Things Podcast, with new episodes every Thursday.